Welcome to you. This is Blind Line, the original interactive talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. I'm Jonathan Mosen. Thank you for joining us, especially if you're in the United States and you're listening to us live, because it means that you've foregone the Super Bowl Sunday for us, and we appreciate that. I won't even begin to expostulate on Super Bowl, because I know not a thing about it, but if you want to talk about that a bit later in the program, you're most welcome to do that. But to begin with, we're going to hear an interview that was recently recorded by Jim Layton of the Radio Information Service of Belleville, Illinois, with Charlie Crawford, the American Council of the Blind's Executive Director. After that, the lines will be open for you to have your say on anything that takes your fancy, and we might throw a few things into the melting pot at that point. So the interview goes for around about 50 minutes or so. Without any further ado, here's Jim Layton.
Good afternoon and welcome to Talk Back. On this edition of our program, we're going to be talking with the Executive Director of the American Council of the Blind, Mr. Charlie Crawford. Lots have been happening with issues affecting the blind and physically disabled in the last couple of months, so we thought a good way to kick off the new year is to talk with our guest. He's been with us once before. Welcome back to Radio Information Service, Mr. Charlie Crawford. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Well, thank you for having me.
Charlie, as we all know, back in November, the federal court overturned the FCC's ruling mandating descriptive video. Give us some history on all this. Where have we been and where are we going with this today?
Well, let's see. How many days do we have for this show?
25 words or less.
We started with descriptive video many years ago. As a matter of fact, it was as early as 1984 that the first attempts at putting on a described television show happened at WGBH television in Boston. At the time, I was a commissioner of the Commission for the Blind in Massachusetts, so I was involved with the original attempts to get that done and supporting WGBH in the process. It was a pretty big success early on, because people who had seen demos of, say, for example, a Sherlock Holmes movie with video description were amazed at all that was not necessarily presented in a way that a blind person could appreciate it. And so the method got pretty instantaneous popularity amongst the people who had seen it. And as a result, both conventions of ACB and NFB ultimately began to adopt like a kind of a movie night where they'd have the latest DVS movie described video. And so as time went on, people were more and more impressed with it, and there was a belief that it really ought to be part of what television ought to do as a normal course of business. And so as early as the early 90s, there were efforts being made in Congress to, in effect, get some kind of mandate to provide for video description on television. As a matter of fact, during the early 90s, when the Democrats were still in power in the Congress, in the House of Representatives anyway, Chairman Markey of the Telecommunications Subcommittee was my congressman. And so at that point, I had visited with him, and I was pretty upset at the fact that not a whole lot was happening with DVS. And I got a commitment from him that, okay, this coming year will be the year for the blind and DVS, and we'll get it done. And, of course, that very coming year, the whole situation changed with the Republican Revolution, and the House of Representatives went the other way in terms of party. So that sort of blew it for DVS, at least at that time. But fortunately, DVS is not a partisan subject. Everybody loves it, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or whatever. And so there was a lot of interest in the House and in the Senate to do something positive with respect to DVS. But unfortunately, there was not enough of a strong will or information available at that point in the middle 90s to justify them putting in a mandate as they did for closed captioning for the deaf. So as a result of that, they did get language into the law that essentially advised or mandated the FCC do a study on video description, and they did that. But nothing was going anywhere very fast. So As a result, a coalition of groups interested in DVS, including ACB, essentially were able to lobby at the Federal Communications Commission for them to do something with the results of the study that they had had. And fortunately for us, the FCC voted on a 3-2 margin, three of the commissioners voting in favor of and two against, mandating descriptive video for at least 50 hours of programming per month per major network and cable provider. Well, so all of that was pretty well organized in 2002. And what then happened is unfortunate that the industry, the movie industry, the Motion Picture Association of America, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the National Cable Television Association all were upset by having to do something, and so essentially went to court. And back at last November 8th, we unfortunately lost in court because the court, in this new spirit of what's called construction law, or essentially basically you get the most narrow interpretation of law from the courts these days. So they said because there wasn't an express mandate from Congress in the law for the FCC to mandate video description, that they could not uphold the rule of the commission, Federal Communications Commission, and sort of killed it. We believe that our best shot at remedying the problem is going to be through some kind of congressional effort, because essentially what the court says said is because Congress didn't mandate it, didn't say expressly to the FCC to do it, then the FCC didn't have that authority. However, if the Congress were to provide that express mandate in the coming session of Congress and the bill were to pass and become law, then I think the FCC would be fine in terms of reintroducing or just starting up the rule again. And then we'll see where we go from there. I mean, there are some difficulties. I mean, the industry has raised this curious question of constitutionality of a mandated video description, e.g. that since the artist prepared a work of art to be presented, of course, you know, some people would not necessarily agree that everything on TV is a work of art, but irrespective of that, the point is that they say that because it's a work of art that's meant for a particular presentation by the author of the work, then it would be an abridgment of that author's freedom of speech to alter with the presentation vis-a-vis video description. Now, it's kind of a silly argument in some people's minds, and other people who are more esoteric think, well, maybe there's a point there. That could end up being a problem, because then we'd have to go through the court system all over again based on the constitutionality of it all. I think in the end we would win simply because it's pretty far-fetched to essentially say that describing what's going on the screen is somehow altering the artistic work of the producer. But I had to put that in there because that is a realistic consideration in terms of our advocacy.
Right. One of the players in DVS and the whole court business has been the National Federation of the Blind.
Yeah, yeah.
In limited conversations that I've had with Dr. Mark Mallard, the president, he still maintains the only way he can endorse mandatory descriptive video is the weather and the news bulletins. Your comments on his?
Partly sunny, partly cloudy. let me see. That's interesting that you put it that way, because I just listened to the weather report that the guy gave me. So, well, I can't tell how many inches of snow going to be here. That's about as iffy as the statement that they really couldn't support mandatory video description without having the so-called video scripting done, which is the information that crawls across the bottom of the screen. Now, let's take a look at that for a moment. Logically, here you got the TV programs going on. So there's dialogue in the TV program, unless you're watching a silent movie, of course.
Right.
And on top of that dialogue, then you've got these spaces between the dialogue in which somebody can insert some video description as to what's going on visually. You know, a man is approaching from the back with a knife in his hand.
Stabs the person in the back six times.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, it's I was just using that for dramatic sake. But anyway, so you've got the dialogue going on, you've got the video description going on, and now you want to add a third level of voice into this equation by speaking whatever the scrolling text is at the bottom of the screen. Now, people who are familiar with television from years ago know that TV started out as basically talking radio. It was pretty much all dialogue and narration. And so Dragnet wouldn't be any different on TV than it would be on the radio, except there were pictures. But as the medium grew and matured, and as new people came into the writing for television and producing of television, their whole orientation to the media is very different than people who had grown up with radio. So we went from radio with pictures to pictures with dialogue, and now there are instances now where the dialogue and the pictures, even though the dialogue is relevant to what's going on, doesn't really describe in any real way what's going on the pictures. So all of that is to say that in a medium that has gone from talking radio radio with pictures, to a medium that not only has gone to a whole lot more visual presentation, but now is trying to imitate or mimic a website when you're watching television, so that not only do you get the picture of the program that's going on, but you also get all these little scrolls of text and sub pictures on the screen of other things going on in the world, so that, for example, you know, plane crashes in Tunisia might appear at the bottom of the screen with a little icon of the capital of Tunisia or whatever. And then another part of the screen, there might be something else going on that's being scrolled as well in terms of text. Now, it's impossible, literally, to put that much audio into the track of the program without creating a whole lot of dissonance for the viewer, I think. So there's a real problem with this whole notion of, well, we should have everything that's scrolling across the screen described. Well, the fallback argument that I've heard from the folks in the Federation is, well, we really don't need to have everything described. What we need is to have emergency information described, you know, whether or not there's a tornado coming down the pike. Reality of that is the federal regulations, FCC rules, already call for television stations to break in when it comes to that kind of disaster or problem, so that the likelihood of a serious piece of information being missed by a blind person watching television is fairly small. Then even if we agreed that there ought to be that kind of video scripting, as it were, we think there might be ways of accomplishing that don't interfere with the video description of the TV show. For example, there's a system they have in upstate New York at one of the cable companies that if, you know, like a hurricane warning comes at the bottom of your screen, there'll be a tone that's announced, and that tone beeps, and then you can go to channel 19 on that system where they'll have a artificial voice basically reading whatever it was at the bottom of the screen. That's not a bad solution. It creates more work for the cable company, but it ultimately could be a solution that, especially with digital television now coming down the pike, we probably would be able to get. So we're not technically against what the Federation is saying in terms of wanting access to that information. Everybody wants access to the information. The issue is, what are the trade-offs you make when you design a system to get the information to you? And sometimes you just can't have it all, at least not in the first cut.
Do you see this as a stall tactic by the Federation?
Oh, well, far be it for me to put myself inside the mind of Baltimore. I mean, I don't know necessarily what they're thinking. My belief is that they are caught between a rock and a hard place. I think they have, on the one hand, a membership that wants DVS, and on the other hand, they have a philosophical set of strictures or rules in their organization that essentially says, well, you know, you should ask for the least amount of accommodation you absolutely must have in society, so that you don't necessarily point out the fact that you're blind and increase a social negative attitude. When you have that kind of conflict going on, I'm surprised that they have any kind of coherency in their argument, but the reality is that I think they've done the best they can under the philosophical constrictions that they have. Now, from our point of view, ACB, you know, we we take a different way of developing our policies. I mean, essentially our policy is that if the membership is upset about something or thinks something needs to get done and expresses that in a resolution on the floor of the convention and it's voted and passed, then it's a reflection of what the community believes it needs rather than being some kind of set of rules that we think they ought to follow. So it's a very different approach to policy making.
Now, you talked a minute ago about possibly going before Congress. What is the council's next step?
Well, we've had some preliminary meetings already with key staffers in Congress, and I think they're pretty sensitive and open to the arguments that we raised. I mean, in the end, it really is a question of fairness. To the extent that folks who are deaf richly deserve the closed captioning they get, to the extent that that's true, that also implies that, well, perhaps the blind, as another sensorily impaired group, ought to have access as well, and at least an equal measure to that which is given to folks who are deaf. At the time that the deaf community was fortunate enough to get the regulation and rules that they got, or the law they got, there was already in place a closed captioning system of information delivery. And so it wasn't as if they had to reinvent the wheel or they had to build a whole new system. It was already there. It was just a matter of expanding it. Fortunately, the FCC rule as it was promulgated in ultimate compliance by the networks and cable stations and direct-to-satellite people, fortunately, they had to put an infrastructure in place as well. So fact of the matter is that we're relatively in the same position now as the deaf were then, and it's just a matter of saying to the Congress, well, now that the system is actually in place, they should do it, and they should expand programming. The interesting question that comes up with all of that is, well, so what's going to happen in the era of digital television? Well, we know that it's coming. How soon it comes is a real interesting question. I mean, that Congress has tried to mandate that digital TV be on the scene by 2007.
So do you include that in your legislation with DVS at the same time?
Well, yeah, we'll get to that. The issue of digital TV is still up in the air, no pun intended. I mean, it's going to be probably more like 2010 or 12 before digital television as a commercial venture actually works, only because people are not in a position to spend $2,000 on a TV set when we have an economy in which people are losing money in the stock market, not working, and on and on and on. So even though we ultimately will have to deal with digital TV and digital radio, I'm not so sure that it's going to happen as soon as everybody thinks. Be that as it may, the question then becomes, well, how do we find a vehicle in Congress by which we can attach statutory language with respect to scripted video? And should that statutory language only be a repetition of what the Federal Communications Commission rule has been, or should it be something different? I think we're going to have to go with the digital legislation that potentially will happen in Congress. And in that legislation, we can address both the current situation, which is the analog situation, the way people receive TV today.
Right.
And then at the same time address the digital situation by making the mandate cross-platform on the digital as well as analog. And then we have to look at other interesting possibilities.
What do you do about cable boxes and those wonderful on-screen program guides?
Well, there you go. Now, you must have anticipated my next sentence, because one of those interesting possibilities is called convergence technology. And essentially what that means is that because the likelihood of information processing being the same as it's always been is very small, you're not going to have a different telephone receiver and a different TV set and a different stereo system and a different FM receiver and on and on and on. Ultimately, what's going to happen through whatever delivery vehicle gets set up or wins out in the competition for the marketplace, ultimately it's going to be a converged technology where you'll essentially make choices between different information processing events on some kind of master box. And that box is likely to be the set-top box that's going to be on top of your cable TV. Although there is a movement now essentially fairly strong consumer movement in the general consumer community to try and get the FCC to rule that television sets should be, in effect, digital cable ready, and you shouldn't have to have a different set-top box. You should just get it on your TV. And that may win, I mean, because there's a lot of consumer interest in that happening. While on the other side of the fence, there's a whole lobby of industry out there that wants to have what are called proprietary standards so that only their boxes will work with their systems on your TV. However, it comes out, whether it's open system or proprietary. The fact of the matter is that blind people still are stuck with the same problem. If you get a menu that comes up there and that menu is not accessible to you, no matter what you've got for descriptive video, you're not going to be able to get to the program you want to watch simply because you don't know it's there.
Right.
We think that some of the solutions that are out there now in terms of technology could be applied satisfactorily to this problem so that in any kind of legislation we go for, it's highly likely that we will seek to have some kind of requirement, almost like the V-chip or almost like the decoder for deaf folks in terms of closed captioning, that will interface with the information delivery module so that a person who's blind will be able to hear and manipulate the menus and all the different options that come both with the TV set, as a TV set, as well as the information being passed to it.
While we're on the subject of accessibility, Charlie, I want to talk about accessible voting. President Bush back in October signed the Help American Vote Act. How does that help us get into a voting booth without sighted assistance? Can you give us some insight on that?
Well, first of all, it was a big victory for the disability community at large, and I think for ACV in particular, to have gotten the Congress to essentially, after many different versions of the bill, after many different delays and false starts and debates and on and on and on, finally agree on a bill that would provide for both a quasi-mandate for accessible voting, because, you know, there are loopholes in the law. But on the whole, it's reasonable to anticipate as a citizen of the United States that if you have a disability, you're going to be able to use a accessible voting booth by the year 2006. But outside of the mandate, they also included money. And money is the kind of money is the grease that makes the engine go, you know? So there's about $500 million, I think, in there in terms of initial aid to the states for the purchase and implementation of accessible voting machines. The issue is going to be partly at the local level and partly at the federal level. The feds are going to have to provide the money. Now, there's some concern right now that the potential war in Iraq and homeland security needs and
terrorism,
all the other things that drain money away from the Treasury might put this off for a while, and that would be a real problem. But assuming that doesn't happen, then the federal government will make these funds available to the states. The states have to have some kind of plan for making their voting areas accessible to people. And so it's really going to be in part a responsibility of our local affiliates. Now, I'm talking in terms of ACB right now, but, you know, BNFB as well and whoever else. Local affiliates, local chapters, local people are going to have to be talking with the voting officials to make sure that the voting officials are actually knowledgeable about and taking advantage of the opportunities to make the places accessible. Now, after having said all that, I voted in an accessible voting booth this last election. And, of course, my candidates lost, but that's not unusual.
What kind of experience was it, though?
It was wonderful. It was just wonderful. I mean, you know, you get to sit there and you're just like a telephone pad. You just, you know, hit one number for the next election and, you know, select your vote with another number and move backwards and forwards in terms of all the things that you've done. And, you know, what's really cool about it was they had some of those citizen petitions or initiatives on the ballot, so you got to listen to the pros and cons about the question at hand, and then make your choice, make your vote.
Were you using headphones?
Oh, yeah. And the funny thing was that you walk out of there and you can have discussions with people just like everybody else. You know, well, you know, that's so-and-so. And it was great. I mean, it was just like, well, what can I say? It was normal.
Yeah. Which machine?
I think I used the Diebold one.
While we're on the subject of this voting issue, how are the Secretary of State's offices reacting now that the funding's there? Because they were part of the problem, were they not?
Well, they're only part of the problem from two perspectives. One was funding. I mean, they didn't want to have to be responsible for trying to implement a mandate that they didn't have any money for. And the second one was, for the most part, Secretaries of State are oftentimes only partial players in the election process because it's the local county or municipality elections boards that seem to have the power in this country, more so than other countries in the world where they might have a much more federalized system. Because remember, in this country, there's been a traditional, even constitutional requirement that there be a whole lot of separation of powers. So it's not like you can just say this happens in Washington and all of a sudden it happens everywhere else. It's just not like
right.
that.
The issue is to be by 2006. How realistic do you see that, and what hurdles do you think you and the council are going to have to overcome to get that done? Because that seems like an awful early date.
Well, it may not happen in a number of places, but I think for the most part it's going to happen only because there seems to be a genuine consensus around the country that voting reform, the time has come. The 2000 election is still fresh in people's memories, and the people who do the elections themselves are pretty thrilled at the fact that they're actually getting some attention, you know, because for the most part, I mean, over the years, I mean, elections councils and superintendents of elections weren't exactly the most sexy topic.
How are you going to get those election judges in the actual polling places educated on this? Because that seems, I know when I voted and I had to have sighted assistance, it can be a bit of a hassle. Is there going to be a lot of trouble teaching them how to teach us how to use the system?
I don't know. I mean, I think we did a pretty good job of it in Montgomery County, where I live, and the ACB affiliate in Montgomery County participated in the training of the elections folks, which in turn gave them the upper hand in terms of being able to assist people when they came to the voting booths. And the companies themselves, the manufacturers, did a fair amount of training as well. I think it really is a question that you have to up front with more than just a couple of months ahead of time start training people for this process.
Right.
But if the local affiliates, as I suggested before, who after all have the biggest investment in terms of this thing working, are willing to work with the elections officials, you usually get a pretty good marriage.
If you can, Charlie, let's talk a little bit about this task force on transportation, because if you don't have transportation, you can't get to the voting booth.
Yes.
What can you tell us about this task force, its goals and objectives? What is it looking at?
Well, actually, we're pretty pleased with our whole approach to the task force for transportation. Now, everybody recognizes that there are two classic, basically two or, well, there are more than two classic, but the most utilized ways of transport are either the public transit system.
Or paratransit.
You might have a good uncle or somebody that takes you places from time to time, but the reality is that as a matter of day-to-day expectation, blind people who travel a lot tend to use one of those two modes. Now, having said that, the problem is it's pretty scattered in terms of the quality. For example, here where I am in Washington, D.C., the metro system is just wonderful. I mean, there's lots of trains, lots of buses. I have four buses that pass at the two ends of my street, you know, and I'm in a residential neighborhood. This is not like a major thoroughfare that the bus goes down. One of them is. But anyway, the point is that for me, the public transit system works very well. But if I were living in another city where they've not paid as much attention to public transit, like Oakland, California, for example, you could end up being close to but not ever being able to get the public transportation that you need, only because either A, it doesn't run often enough, or B, there's all kinds of inaccessible street you have to cross and that sort of thing, that it would make it far more dangerous to try and use regular transit than to use paratransit. So then you go to the paratransit model, and just like I said, you know, with regard to the regular fixed transit, the fact of the matter is that there are a number of places in the country where some places it's really good and some places it's really bad. So given that as a as the background, then we have this national policy, the ADA and the Department of Transportation, trying to work on some kind of national level of expectation with regard to transit, and people just don't know from one jurisdiction to another, either A, what their rights are, because people don't really understand all the ins and outs of the ADA as it relates to paratransit, for example, or they may know what their rights are, but the fact of the matter is that the either the transit system or the public entity is not necessarily cooperating. And what happens is that people feel defeated. They feel like there's really not much they can do about it. And you just should be grateful for what you get. And, you know, even some of the transit systems, unfortunately, are actively engaged in that kind of mentality that, you know, well, you should be happy we're picking you up. So from ACB's point of view, that's an intolerable situation. You really should have some reasonable expectation of what you can get from public transit, and public transit ought to be able to meet that minimum demand. And then secondly, as far as paratransit is concerned, there ought to be some level of a universal or national system whereby no matter where you live, it's pretty much the same in terms of being able to request and receive paratransit. And what that paratransit eligibility ought to be as well. I mean, we obviously think that at least for conditional eligibility, blind people should be automatically eligible for public transit. I mean, for paratransit. And even though there are a number of us who don't use paratransit, that shouldn't prejudice the transit system from allowing other blind persons who want to use that system to go ahead and do it. So our committee or task force was set up in recognition of this whole hodgepodge and big mess around the country. And what we've done is essentially we put together a pretty good, comprehensive, some would say long, survey with regard to people's the issues around public transit. And we are about to launch a campaign of getting folks both inside and outside of ACB to answer this survey. And then we have some software that we're developing to do the analysis and all that and produce a report for all the necessary decision makers in the field of transportation so that they have at least the benefit of knowing where the blind community is, more or less nationally, with regard to our issues of transportation and what the potential remedies are. Now, in addition to that, there's been this nifty little project going on at what's called Project Action, which is a partnership between the public transportation systems and the disability community funded by the federal government to essentially come up with better ways of making transportation a more viable option for people with disabilities. And as part of that eligibility process study that's going on, there's been a subgroup for blind people, and I think it's reasonable to say that within the next couple of months, the report of that group should be out to all the public transportation authorities around the country, and that report, as far as I know, or at this point, will contain that language about presumed conditional eligibility for people who are blind for paratransit.
Good afternoon. You're on Talkback with Charlie Crawford.
Well, Charlie, we had gotten a copy of the questionnaire that they were going to give out to the blind people to use for the paratransit around here, and they said, can you find your way around your backyard? And when I read that to Melanie, her comment was, I haven't seen a car in my backyard yet.
It's a bizarre question in some ways, and clearly for those of us that are used to doing a lot of mobility, it's pretty silly. But unfortunately, those kinds of questions are aimed at the full breadth of the community. So there are people who, for whatever reasons, most would argue simply because they haven't had the opportunity to talk with other blind people and get some confidence, actually feel that they can't get around their backyard. And it's it's unfortunate, but you know, those kinds of questionnaires can, on the one hand, be pretty intimidating and stupid, whereas on the other hand, for some people at least, it gives them a start towards coming out of whatever shell they're in.
Audible pedestrian traffic signals, and I want to ask you, Charlie, I know the Access Board was taking testimony with all that. Where are we with that decision?
Sounds so thrilled
there, Charlie.
Well, we're watching the molasses races in Washington. You know, there's a process in Washington to everything. And unfortunately, when it comes to the ultimate definition of what the rules will be, as they relate to the public right-of-way, sidewalks, that sort of thing, that process involves first soliciting comments from people on the original report of the committee, Public Rights-of-Way Committee, second, having that report then published and asking for people's opinion of that, and then after that's done, the Access Board makes its own proposed regulations defining the rules of what should happen in the public right-of-way. And then after it goes through all that, it goes to the Department of Justice, where they technically have to decide whether or not that's consistent with the ADA.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that happens, ultimately it becomes a rule which has the force of law. So in that sense, things are going slowly. The positive side is that we have enjoyed a level of acceptance by the Institute of Traffic Engineers, which has been fairly high for that group. And people are really starting to get it in terms of there needs to be the ability of a blind person to know what the information is that other people are relying upon across the street. And the more sophisticated the intersection designs become, the more necessary it is to get those technologies in place that can help people to negotiate successfully at those intersections.
One of the real problems going on with this is those nice hybrid electrical cars.
Okay.
And there's an incident where a blind person got hit because he couldn't find his traffic. Doesn't that add weight to the fire of what you're talking about?
It certainly does. We are going to be asking Congress, or at least the Department of Transportation, to include some kind of requirement in the manufacture of these vehicles that there be the ability of somebody to hear, but they're there. I don't know how far we'll get with that, but it clearly is not only a clear danger, but I think an imminent danger to blind people, because no matter what you do in terms of listening for traffic at an intersection to determine when it's right for you to go, fact of the matter is, if the car is damn near silent, then not only are they it's a problem picking up when they're leaving, but it's also a problem for right on red.
You're on Top Back with Charlie Crawford.
Hi, I just have one comment I'd like to make on the traffic signals. The audible traffic signals, and I'm going to get to my main question, and that is the one thing that they must be is standard. They must be universal. And I think that is the first thing that should be stated whenever you're discussing audible traffic signals. I want the same thing in St. Louis that I have in San Francisco, that they have in Chicago, New York, et cetera, because I don't want to have to learn 27 different audible traffic signals when I travel.
Isn't it the Unified Code Traffic System, Charlie?
Yeah, the manual on uniform traffic control devices. There, I got it out.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, easy for me to say.
I must have been dialing when you mentioned that, because I missed that. Okay. But my question is, hold on.
The problem with the MUTCD is that it has certain standards in there, but that's not by no means universal in terms of its interpretation of what ought to be. So this Public Rights of Way Access Advisory Committee has further defined pedestrian signalization so that the standard that you're looking for, you're talking about, could become a reality and should become a reality. We certainly agree with that. As a matter of fact, this week, last week and this week here in Washington, we've been attending meetings on that very subject. So hopefully the Institute of Traffic Engineers will be helpful to us, and we'll get to the subject of roundabouts in a few minutes.
I mean, red, right, and the arrows are red, green, the arrows, the caution lights, they're all universal. So why can't the audible signals be universal? It's always been my
argument. Well, they are to an extent. I mean, there are different, red means stop, green means go. Arrows pointing in a particular direction usually mean go in that direction.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I mean, there are certain little subtleties they do use in different places that, in the final analysis, don't amount to a hill of beans. But, you know, when it comes to the kind of information we need and the way to deliver it, it is pretty important that it be pretty consistent.
Okay. Anyway, this is my main question. This is something that I've noticed. Is there a legal definition for the term visually impaired? A legal definition of blind? You know, 10%, 2200, blah, 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 limited field of vision for, what, I guess almost 70 years now. But I'm seeing, and this is getting, they're throwing this politically, I guess it started out as a politically correct term of visually impaired. And if you look at the dictionary definition, you figure visually impaired means anybody whose uncorrected sight is not 20/20. So what I know of at least one case of this, and I'm not going to give any names on the air, Jim, so don't ask.
Okay.
Where there is somebody who has gone through the system as a person who is visually impaired and has a valid driver's license because of corrected vision is good enough to drive.
Right.
And I'm worried about the visually impaired, that it's become a bureaucratic crutch that the people can say, okay, we're helping the visually impaired, but of course the people that are totally blind are left out in the cold again.
Charlie, wasn't that kind of more set up for someone like me who's not totally blind but not normal sight?
Because
I fell in the cracks all over the place because they couldn't categorize me as blind and they couldn't categorize me as 20/20 vision.
Right. For the purposes of the Rehabilitation Act, visually impaired means a person with 20/70. Essentially what that says is that legal blindness, 20 over 200 or 10 degrees or less of vision in the fields, is legal blindness. No matter whether you can see a little bit or not, I mean, you're legally blind. Then visual impairment as a clinical term essentially refers to people who are not legally blind but still have impaired vision. Now, the problem with that is that you're absolutely right, caller, that the political correctness thing did sort of creep in there big time. And so people have always tried to refer to themselves as visually impaired because for especially newly blinded people, that's not as hard a thing to say as blind. It's kind of
like I can understand that. Yeah,
it's kind of like the old George Carlin thing, you know, where they talked about post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
It started out in World War One as shell shock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Combat fatigue. Yeah, okay, I understand that. But as I say, I just worried that it's going to work, and I think it already has worked its way into the bureaucracy.
Yeah. We're a little concerned, as you are. I mean, you know, when you have people who are receiving services as a blind person and then driving to work, creates a sort of dissidence in the mind of the other employees. I think, you know, we're not totally decided yet on how the community needs to respond to that, whether it's okay or not okay or somewhere in between. But we really do have to grapple with that because it does create, in those circumstances where it happens, a real problem for other blind people.
Anything else, John?
No, as I say, I just would like to see something in the ACB with your magazine, the forum. About that on a little more regular basis. But thank you very much.
What can you tell us about the Stephanie Donen case with the Iowa Center for the Blind? I know you really want to talk about that.
Yes. Well, it's an interesting case, and as you know, the Guide Dog Users Incorporated, which is our affiliate, basically brought a complaint to the Department of Justice based upon what they have labeled as an act of discrimination in that a person who uses a guide dog was denied the ability to attend the Adult Rehabilitation Center or program at the Iowa Commission for the Blind. And their point of view of the Iowa Commission, as we best understand it, is that they believe that there is there's a need for people to learn how to use the white cane, a long white cane, to be independent and to, quote, no blindness to their soul, close quote. And that anybody who introduces the dog into the equation while people are learning this long white cane technique, could distract those people into thinking about getting a dog themselves and thereby cancel out the therapeutic benefit of knowing yourself to your soul as a blind person vis-a-vis the cane. So that's probably as rough a definition as I can give to the nub of the problem. Where we go with this as a community is a fascinating kind of question. I mean, on the one hand, there is some merit, I think, to people saying, well, you need to learn mobility and you need to be able to use a white cane. But the problem there is that if you globalize that statement to every possible activity happening at a center and that the introduction of a dog into the equation is somehow deleterious or adverse to the results you're seeking, then what you do essentially is to say or define a guide dog as somehow being less than the standard of mobility that you would learn with a white cane. And certainly guide dog users are not prepared to accept that. Guide dog schools clearly are not prepared to accept that. And the law, the ADA, is neither ready to accept that because it says clearly that you cannot discriminate against any person who is otherwise qualified using a guide dog in any public place or activity deny the benefits of somebody or activities conducted by a public program.
The question many have been asking me to ask you, sir, is why did the council not take what would seem the next logical step and join them in this suit? Can you talk about that or not?
Well, I can only report to you what the Braille Forum has in its winter
edition. I read that article. Very interesting.
Right. Yeah. There was a concern at the board level for, some of the particulars and whether or not there was an actual need for ACB itself to become a complainant as opposed to supporting GDY in its efforts. And the conclusion was that it ought to support GDY in its efforts. Now, that was not a universal agreement, that's for sure. However, that was what the board voted.
How much of a factor did the Iowa Council of United Blind play in a role of helping the council make their non-decision? Because if you go to the
substantial, my friend, substantial. I mean, there was a belief, and there is a belief in the affiliate in Iowa that the it's not entirely unreasonable for the state to take the position that learning the use of the long white cane and then becoming proficient in mobility that way is something that a person needs to do, and then the next logical step for them is that in the environment of learning there needs to be consistency, so therefore the introduction of a dog is counterproductive to the ends of the state program.
Is it a correct assumption that they basically threatened to pull out of the council?
Well, I don't know if you want to categorize it as a threat. I think what they did say was that they anticipated that were ACB itself to become a complainant in the case, that they would probably be a call for a meeting for them to consider whether or not they could remain with the council. I think that's true. And a lot of it got tied up in this whole issue of states' rights in the sense that does a national organization does it have the right to require its state affiliates to necessarily buy into something or not? And, when posed in that framework, I mean, I think most people would agree that that's a fairly sensitive question. I mean, there's some would argue that a state may have the right to dissent against the national organization and take its own position, but that the national organization is not compelled by that action of the state to necessarily take a different position than what it thinks is right. Others would contend that if there's a way to handle this that would ultimately result in upholding the civil rights of Ms. Dolan and at the same time provide for the state to feel that it wasn't necessarily being put on that spot, then that was a good way to go. The wisdom of the ultimate decision will be decided by the membership, should they care to take that up at the convention.
With the little time I got left, Charlie, I want to turn our attention to the ADA and this issue with Mark Foley, Republican congressman from Florida, this ADA Notification Act, House Resolution 914.
Right.
I think it's important because it's not only going to affect wheelchair people, but maybe finding the doorway and getting in the building. What are your thoughts about what he's trying to do?
Oh, the 90-day notice law?
Yes, sir.
Well, it's our position that businesses have had the opportunity for the last 12 years since the ADA passed to know what their requirements are. So this should not be like news to them. Having said that, we also recognize that a number of businesses are small. There are a lot of priorities. The people essentially run their business hoping that they don't get caught. I mean, and what's happened is that because there's a active group of litigants down there in Florida, they've gone after a number of different businesses, and so the businesses feel that they've been unfairly put upon, and this guy who is the congressman comes up with this particular 90-day notice rule. Now, what that does essentially is if I go to a business and they're not doing something under the ADA, I have to give them 90 days notice before I can sue them. The rationale is that they can then fix the problem in that 90-day period of time or face a lawsuit. So that sounds eminently reasonable to some people.
However,
it ultimately gives license to every business in the country to essentially do nothing until somebody gives them notice. And that, in our view, is not the right way to go.
Now, he has something like 63 co-sponsors in the House and 3 co-sponsors in the Senate. How do you overcome that?
The way we overcome that as a disability community, and I underscore that word community, is to, in common resolve and in united action, to let the Congress know that there are 54 million of us out there and they don't want to mess with us.
What are the goals and objectives of you, the council, in 2003? What do you want to accomplish? Give me a minute, maybe two, and we'll close up with that.
I think we really do want to, as an organization of the blind, we want to make sure that we continue to make our environment increasingly safe for people to travel in and to feel comfortable in. And that secondly, we want people to have an ability to express who they are in our society, whether that's through the arts or whether that's through doing whatever they're doing at work, or all the opportunities that are available to other people. We want blind people to choose what they want to do and then have the power to go out and do it, and that's what we're about.
If somebody wants to call you, give us the 800 number and your email address, sir.
Sure. It's 800-424-8666. That's after 2 o'clock Eastern Time, 800-424-8666. And my email is ccrawford, C-C-R-A-W-F-O-R-D, @acb.org.
Charlie, thank you so much for being with us. We'll talk with you down the road. We appreciate you being with us today.
Thanks.
That's Mr. Charlie Crawford of the Executive Council of the ACB. You've been listening to Talk Back on this Tuesday. I'm Jim Layton, and this is Radio Information Service in Belleville, Illinois.
There you go. We'd like to thank Jim Layton for making that excellent interview available to us of the Radio Information Service of Belleville, Illinois. Some interesting perspectives there from Charlie Crawford. And now your chance to have your say. As we broadcast live, it is Super Bowl Sunday. This is not something I feel terribly qualified to talk about, but I presume that it's still going. I have heard that the Dixie Chicks sang a very creditable, in fact, even highly marvelous version of the Star Spangled Banner. So I hear from Shannon, who is a good judge of these matters, so I certainly believe that she's true. She's right. So anyway, if you're not listening to the Super Bowl, or perhaps you've got an ear on both and you'd like to comment on any of the issues that were raised during that interview, the whole matter of pedestrian signalling and audible signals and how we make sure there are standards so that you don't get conflicting signals, so to speak, if you'll pardon the pun, go to one city and find that a chirp means something, and go to another city and find that a chirp means something else and a bleep means something else. And that's certainly a bit of an issue here in this country, in New Zealand, where I'm from. We experience that problem too. Another issue that you might like to talk about, and by the way, the number is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And when Spiderphone asks you to enter a conference code, then you enter 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. One thing I'd like your opinion on, everybody has been talking about war with Iraq. It's been coming up in the tea rooms, the coffee rooms, the lunch rooms around the world as people get together and talk, and of course in the pubs and on the email lists. Some email lists even where the topic doesn't really belong. But the thought occurred to me as I was looking at a blindness angle on this. I wonder whether there are people who feel so strongly about this issue that they want to serve their country to help defeat Iraq and disarm Iraq. And what options are available to blind people in terms of military service? Or in fact, are there options? Are there desk jobs that are available to blind people to do in the military service? Or, in fact, I seem to recall there was a resolution that came up on this topic at the ACB convention last year. Because I suppose if you're enrolled in the military, there's always that possibility that you may have to go out and fight or serve in some way. So what do you do if you really want to serve your country and you want to contribute in some way to the military effort? Are there options available to blind people? Does anybody feel that way strongly, that they want to contribute? Your thoughts are always welcome. Let's go to the phones. Hello, this is Blindline.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
It's Alan from New York.
How are you?
Okay.
Good.
Interesting you brought up the war. Yes, I, first of all, as much as I don't like war, I think the war with Iraq is unfortunately necessary, because this guy can't be trusted, our friend Hussein over there. Also, yeah, I would like, I've often questioned what, you know, what I, as a blind person, could do in the military. You know, I'm good with radio, for example. In that capacity, you know, for one thing, I'd like to, even after 9/11, the first thing I thought was, boy, what I wish I could do to serve my country. But, of course, you know, obviously in a non-combatant way. But, yeah, that is a good thing, and I really think that we should be given options to do things like that. In fact, my father was a veteran in World War II, and he tried to get me into the service as a radio technician, but of course they wouldn't do it. But yeah, I'm a strong advocate of that.
Do you think that the laws need to be relaxed then, so that people who could make a contribution, not necessarily in combat?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, obviously there are certain areas we couldn't participate, but there are certain we could.
It seems logical to me. I was interested in your comment that... I was interested in your comment that you were saying Saddam can't be trusted.
Nah, I don't trust him.
Seems to me, though, that Israel has breached just as many UN resolutions, if not more, than Iraq has.
Yeah.
No one's going to war with them.
I know, but I just don't know. I don't know. He makes too many promises. He says too many things, and it's just too much... I don't know. I just think he's too dangerous and too he's good at what he does.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how people react to what the UN weapons inspectors have to say. And of course, another critical thing coming up this week is going to be George Bush's State of the Union address.
I know. What? When is that going to be on?
I believe that is Tuesday night your time. Yes, that's right. It'll be Wednesday UTC.
What time over here?
I think it'll be 9. I think it's 9 Eastern normally.
Yeah, I'm gonna listen to that because I want to hear what he has to say. But you know, on another issue, one of the things that what's his name, the guy that was doing the interview, had said was about the accessibility of the cable equipment.
Yeah.
You know, I have Time Warner Cable here in New York, and they have some very good cable converters. How much do you know about the cable converters that are out there, John?
Not a lot at all.
Well, I have the digital boxes, and I was wondering what I could do, or if somebody would know what I could do, to either have them either interface with my talking computer or something to make them, because like they've got things like pay-per-view, they got things like what they call MOD, which is movies on demand, where you can actually order a movie. It's like renting a tape, but you order the movie, and you can forward it, rewind it, stop it, play it, and all this. But all right, to my point is there's a menu on the screen of titles of the movies.
Yes.
It's not even in print form, online form or anything. It's only there on the screen. And I was wondering what I could do to make this, talk.
Yeah, see, this is one of the next frontiers, really, and we are going to hopefully speak in a couple of weeks or so to Greg Vanderheiden of the Trace Research Center in Wisconsin, and apparently they're doing some work on all of this universal access stuff, and they have been for years. But I think that, at least in the short term, one of the answers is to demand an alternative interface. Over here, for example, in our pay-for-view systems, we have a voice response system that you can call with an 0800 number, so like a toll-free number. And from there, they have the menus of all of the movies you can order, and all you need to do is punch in. Yeah, well, see,
they took all that away.
You know, that's outrageous.
In fact, what they have now is, and of course I think it's unfair, you can call them up and have them, you know, order it for you, but you have to pay a fee because you're using them. And I think, you know, naturally that's not equal access in my book.
I agree.
And also with the MODs, they can't even tell me what's available.
Well, we've got to do something about that. And it's not, of course, just this. You also look at how menu-driven, microwaves, and fridges, it goes on and on.
Of course.
Mm.
While I have you on the phone, John, how are you with Winamp?
How am I with Winamp? I would say I was a Winamp power user.
Okay. Can you assist me with the equalizer in that program?
Yeah.
Okay, when you bring up the equalizer and you have the context menu, you have the load pull down, the save pull down. Under load, there's something called load preset and auto load preset.
Mm-hmm.
And also under the save pull down, you've got load preset and auto load preset, but I'm not quite sure on what it is you're saving or loading or doing. And I really like the program, and I like to find out how I can learn more on what to do.
Well, firstly, how you can find out, there is some Winamp help on the OCB Radio website in text form, and also there has been some stuff done on Winamp on main menu, and you can search the archives for Winamp and play the appropriate piece from main menu. But you can save a set of equalization settings on a per-track basis, and you can save that as the auto-load preset so that whenever that song loads, then those presets, that equalization setting, will automatically load with it.
Oh, it's only on a per-song basis?
Yeah.
You can't do it, you can't save a general preset for everything?
Yes, you can. If you just turn the equalizer on and use the ordinary load menu as opposed to the auto-load presets, then you can just load a setting that applies to all situations.
And it will hold that preset until you change it?
Yes.
Oh, that's good.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's a good program. I hope you have...
It's an excellent program. What about the Real Player and the Windows Media Player? Do they have equalizers?
Yes, they do.
Are they controllable?
Yes. Now, I haven't had too much experience. I don't use Windows Media Player unless I really have to. It just doesn't grab me. Real One I use quite a bit. I really quite like Real One. And you can use the equalizer, but to be honest, I can't quite recall whether that is one of the features that's disabled if you're not paying the $9.95 a month to Real Network. So somebody may be able to tell me about that, because I have the Superpass or whatever they call it, so it's enabled for me, but I'm not sure whether that's one of the features that you have to pay for.
Yeah, because I'm one who likes to control my sound. You know, I want to tailor it.
Well, me too. Yeah.
I just started using a Windows machine a couple of weeks ago. I've been using, you know, I haven't had a Windows machine until just like 2.5 weeks ago, so I'm brand new at this game.
I heard you talking to Terry Lynn, so I'm pleased you've discovered us.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I enjoy listening to you guys. Definitely do.
Well, you might find a wealth of information if you check the main menu archives.
Okay.
Yeah, they'll give you all sorts of...
I've seen the archive page.
Right.
How do I look for the topic that I want?
Well, what screen reader are you using?
Windowize.
Okay. So if you load the shows on demand page and then choose, for example, main menu, it will load a big page of all the past main menus, and all you need to do is use your Windowize Control Shift F command to search.
Okay.
And it will search the page, and you can type in a string like Winamp, and it will put your cursor, your MSAA cursor, on the appropriate show, and you just back tab to the link and press enter, and it will play that program.
Okay. Is there a manual for Winamp around? You know, a full manual?
I don't know whether there's one on the Nullsoft site, but certainly there is a text file in our support center that gives you all the keyboard commands for Winamp and how to use it. So you might like to have a look there.
Okay.
Well, lovely to hear from you, and do keep tuned in.
Will do.
Okay.
Okay, John. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
This is the Super Bowl alternative. Hello to... This is Blind Line, even. Hello. Well, don't talk to me then. Let's just see if we can... Why is it saying click here for help over and over again? I think we might have... Bear with me. It's the Super Bowl. I personally blame the Super Bowl. I don't know why. I'm having a little bit of difficulty controlling Spiderphone today, but it's not Spiderphone's fault. We'll just push this button here, and I think we might be in business. Hello, this is Blindline. Oh, it's...
Hello.
Lovely. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? I just called to get into the show.
Good. Well, you're on, finally. Who's speaking?
My name is Kenny Norton.
How are you, Kenny?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Good, good. What's on your mind?
I'm not paying attention too much to the Super Bowl. It's clearly a one-sider right now, and I just decided to see what this show was, what was happening on this show.
Very good. So it's not a close game?
No. Last time I checked, it was 34-3.
Oh, my goodness. What a turnoff. Who's leading?
It would be the Tampa Bay.
Oh, okay. Well, they were favorites, weren't they?
No. I was hoping it'd be like a close game, a real good game.
Okay.
But apparently it's just a one-sided game.
Well, that does... I mean, yeah, that sounds one-sided by anyone's standards. So what else has been happening?
Nothing much. I've been surfing the internet, and I still go to college, trying to get a degree, and then gainfully employed. Try to get gainfully employed after that.
Good idea. What are you studying?
Computer information technology.
Well, hopefully there's a lot of demand for that out there.
Yeah, I'm hoping it picks back up. the IT sector, I don't know. It just, depending on which company you work for or stuff like that, you never know which way it's going to go.
Well, I guess when you're an undergraduate, when you've just graduated and you're trying to prove yourself, I guess I would go for any company that's willing to employ me.
Yeah,
that's what I would do.
I'm still looking now, I'm trying to get like an internship or something like that to get my, foot in the door.
Oh yeah, like Monica got. Yeah.
Well,
she was an intern.
Something like that.
Look what happened to her.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate you calling in, and I'm sorry the Super Bowl wasn't more exciting.
Yeah, maybe next year.
Yeah, maybe. Have a good night.
You too.
Okay, bye now. There you go, that's Kenny speaking to us. And if you'd like to speak to us, area code 212-812-2800 is the number, 212-812-2800. And then when you're asked for a conference code, it's 0480-5512. Let's say hi to area code 717.
Hey, this here is Danny.
Hi there, Danny.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very well, and yourself?
Okay.
Good.
I'd like to discuss a couple of little things.
Please do.
First of all, the war in Iraq.
Yes.
I do think Saddam has to be dealt with. However, there is one little caveat. I'm patriotic, of course, but let us say that years down the road when some other nation becomes the superpower like China or some other confederation somewhere, and they get powerful and big enough to tell the UN that we need to be sanctioned, or that we need to be inspected or something. I'm not saying it would ever happen, but what if?
Well,
I think, doesn't it?
It does make you think, and I do think we're on
I don't wish that on anyone. Don't get me wrong. I'm a very faithful, patriotic American. But I'm just saying, we cannot always count on being number one in the world.
Well, I think we're on the verge of a very delicate precipice, actually, because if the U.S. and maybe one or two others go it alone on this Iraq issue, I think we may be seeing the end of the United Nations. It will effectively make the United Nations a laughingstock in the same way that the League of Nations was before the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
So I just hope that whatever happens, that it happens with a UN mandate, and that the US and perhaps Britain don't go it alone without a very clear UN mandate to wage war.
Well, I do agree with that, because although I think America's in the right in terms of what we want to do, I think we need the backing of the rest of the world.
So would
things are so delicate.
You made the comment that you're a patriotic American, so would you like to be able to find a way to serve your country in some way if it were threatened, you know?
Well, I tell you, I would not feel at peace if I had to kill anyone, but I would like to do, you know, I wouldn't mind doing something on the home front, you know, like working a computer or radio or telephone or something.
One of the stories that comes to mind when I think about this topic is that during the Second World War, there's quite a famous blind New Zealander who went on to continue to be famous called Arthur Cushion, and he used to sit in his home with a whole lot of very powerful shortwave equipment and antenna and intercept all kinds of messages and let family members know about the fate of their loved ones and prisoners of war camps and various things like that, and that was the contribution that he could make.
That's good. Hey, and the second topic I'd like to first of all, I don't even know Alan, but I'd like to say hello to you, Alan, anyway. And I wish there was a way to give Alan my address. I'm no expert by any means, but I do like to give somebody a couple hints on using Windows when I can. Might there be a way of providing you with my email address or something, and then he could get it from you after the show or something?
Yeah, well, it depends.
Write you and give it to you that way or something.
Well, if you want to give it over the air, that's fine. If not, then drop me an email at support@acbradio.org, and if Alan drops me one, I'll make sure you two try and get together.
All right, you know, if he wants to, you know.
No problem.
Thirdly, I thought of buying a DVD player.
Good idea.
Because, you know, come again?
Good idea.
People tell me about how good DVD is. However, there is one small thing. Say if you want the secondary audio programming or you want extra tracks or whatnot, I have heard that you have to read the menu on the screen.
That's true.
And I wanted to know if I was to buy a DVD player for my computer, you know, one that would go into my computer, would the computer software allow me to do such things right there on my computer with my JAWS?
I believe not, because the menus are graphical. They're not standard, like, pull-down menus. And if I was a blind person living on my own, I must admit I'd be really frustrated by the whole DVD thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely easy to put a disc in the machine, and I haven't, although I've got a DVD drive, I just haven't gotten around to putting a DVD in my PC. But I put it in and whack the play button or the enter or whatever it is, and it generally it plays the feature. But like you say, there are many other things. For example, I've just got the Paul McCartney Back in the US live DVD, and
okay,
it's easy enough to play the main show. But then he's also got backstage footing, and you can even go and watch the sound check where there are three songs that I've never heard him do before. But you really can't.
So you're saying that even with the computer, it will not read the menus?
That's right.
That is terrible.
It is. And see, this is the whole, the next generation of access issues that we're facing. As more and more appliances become more and more graphical, we've really got problems.
I mean, even a stereo. Even when I walk into Radio Shack and want to buy a $200 stereo, a lot of them new stereos have screens.
Yep.
An audio appliance having a screen. I think that is so stupid.
Well, there's even a new standard that's taking hold in Europe. I don't know whether the US is using it or not, where radios can display information on a screen just using regular FM. This isn't, never mind digital radio, which is a whole new and potentially contentious access issue. But this one, you can get the name of the song and the artist displayed, or the call letters of the station, or even traffic information coming over a regular.
See, I would hate that because
you know, this is what we're experiencing. I think I've lost you. I think he's gone. Oh, well, it was a very interesting call anyway. I'll just make sure. Yes, I think he has gone. Oh, well, there you go. You're listening to Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream. And if you'd like to give us a call, you're most welcome to. We have about three people ahead, though, so you may want to hang in there for a little while longer while we get through the backlog. Hello to area code 631.
Good evening, Jonathan.
Hi there, Richard. How are you this evening?
Happy New Year to you.
And to you.
Glad to see you made it through the Christmas and the New Year's unscathed.
I did. Despite a 12,000-foot skydive, I am still unscathed.
Oh, okay. I wouldn't mind doing that myself one of these days.
Oh, very exhilarating.
Yes, I would think so. I would think so. That or hot air ballooning, one of the two.
Yeah, I'd like to do that too.
Yeah, well, you know, picking up on what the other person was saying about DVDs in general, but how about this whole thing with... seems like it's up to Microsoft. We won't be able to play or rip anything unless we have the Microsoft format or have a CD player in the car or whatever that can only play Microsoft format if they finally get their way.
We're on another anti-Microsoft trip again, are we?
Well, I mean, that's... pretty much the way the article had said it. I'm sure you saw that article that was on the PC Audio.
No, I'm not subscribed to the PC Audio list, but I think I know the article you mean.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought at least you still get the mail. Although not that I can blame you. There is a lot of interesting traffic.
I see.
That's on there these days.
Well, I think in a way. You can. It's not surprising that if Microsoft release a media player that also doubles as a ripper, that they will want to endorse the format that Microsoft have produced. I think where we would have to start getting worried is if Windows took some sort of step to stop you from running a standard MP3-based ripper, and with Easy CDDA Extractor, which is by far my favorite ripper, you can make whatever format you like, including MP3. So I don't think Microsoft is trying to in any way prevent you from making MP3 files.
Well, what about the scheme that they want to have where you know, even if you buy a CD and put it in a computer, you'll maybe only be able to play it one or two times, and then if you want to continue playing that particular CD, you have to pay a fee.
Mm. Well, I think that is in response to the RIAA. And, you know, a couple of weeks, we reported on Main Menu, in fact, last week, that there was this agreement that's been signed between computer manufacturers and the IT industry and the music industry. And this seems to me to be all part of a compromise that says, yes, we accept that people do have the right to make legitimate digital copies of music, but they don't have the right to make mass copies. And that perhaps is the compromise they're coming up with.
Yeah.
I mean, why would you want to make mass copies of it anyway? If you could turn your... I'd be quite happy if I could turn my CDs into MP3 files once and maybe twice in case I lose the data. Once you get onto a third, fourth, fifth, sixth time, you have to wonder what you're doing with it.
Well, I think my feeling was, or at least the impression I was getting, is that you couldn't even... The way they wanted to set things up, they said you wouldn't even be able to rip it to MP3s on your hard drive if you wanted to.
Well, I don't think that they... I think that what they're talking about is some integration with Windows Media Player. I don't think that anyone will ever tolerate Microsoft trying to stop the use of third-party MP3 players, and if that ever did happen, then all that would happen was that people would just stop upgrading their versions of Windows, so it wouldn't be in Microsoft's best interest to do that.
Yeah, I was just curious as to what your take on it was, because...
Well, what annoys me more, to be honest, is the situation that some people in Europe are experiencing, which is that they get a CD, and, like me, they just want to make copies because they have a kind of a musical jukebox system set up at home, and they like listening to their discs on that. So they try to copy, for their own personal use,
the files onto their hard drive, and they're being prevented, or at least there's an attempt to prevent them from doing that, through this new copy protection that's on the actual disk in Europe. And I think that's absolutely preposterous, because it compromises fair use.
Well, not only that, I even understand that even if you put it in a regular CD player, sometimes some of these discs won't even play.
That's right, and that's outrageous as well. Yeah, you know, it's a really difficult issue, and the greedy Napster, Kazaa, Morpheus users have caused this by not giving a damn about the implications of freely trading copyrighted music.
So,
you know, they've got what they deserved.
Yeah. And as far as the Warhol thing, I just... I don't have any really gung-ho, wave the flag, and we need to do this whole kind of feeling. I don't know. It just doesn't... The whole Iraq thing just doesn't really sit with me very well. I mean, I know it's something that probably should have been dealt with in the original war and wasn't. And now I guess we have to finish what was started, but I don't envy anyone, any of the soldiers that are going out and having to do it.
No, well, especially if by chance there is chemical weaponry, and by chance it's used, that will be an atrocity.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your call, Richard. It's nice to hear you in 2003 sounding just as perky as you were in 2002.
Yeah.
Okay. Have a good
All
one.
Right.
Are you running XP yet?
Take it.
Are you running XP yet?
Oh, no.
Oh. What are you running?
98.
So did you know that they're going to stop supporting that at the end of June?
Yes, I did.
Whoa, what do you think?
Well, I guess it's like, I guess, you know, it's like what happened with 95. I mean, eventually they're going to, eventually it's going to happen probably eventually with XP in another maybe 5 or 10 years. So I guess I'm comfortable with what I have and what I'm using it for, so I don't really feel a great need to get XP.
Good on you. Well, have a wonderful evening.
You too.
Okay.
And best, and I hope your wife, you have that new one comes away very soon, and hopefully everything goes well.
Yes, and in fact, in American time, it's supposed to be a month today that she's due.
Ah, it's coming up quick.
It is, man. It really is.
Yeah, but you're an old hat.
Well, yeah, but it still doesn't make it any less exciting or nerve-wracking.
Well, actually, she's the one that does all the work, you know.
Well, yes, this is true. Although I like to think that, you know, last time with Amanda being very demanding, you know, I demand that you bring me this within 10 seconds and saying all sorts of terrible things. At one point, I was half strangled. So, you know, men do go through a little bit, but I accept not nearly as much as what women do.
Yes, we need to grin and bear it. Otherwise, we may lose a few things if we're not careful.
Oh, no, she's worth it. You have a good evening.
You too.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
This is Blind Lion, and we say hello to area code 602.
Good evening, or I should say good morning, because it's good morning in New Zealand.
Well, it's actually Monday afternoon now, so good afternoon.
It's already afternoon over there. Well, I'll have to go back and check my time chart. By the way, yep. I have emailed you before, but this is the first time I have talked to you. My name is Ted Chittenden.
Oh, well, nice to hear from you, Ted.
And actually, I am calling about some items I heard on a rerun of your show last week when I heard it on Friday.
Okay.
Couple of quick notes. Number one, I also had a couple of questions, but a couple of quick notes. Number one, you had a caller named Lynn.
Yes.
From Delaware.
Yep.
She was asking about whether or not there were separate hobbyist rates for internet radio. And the answer.
Ah, yes. I thought you'd have the answer to this one. Yep.
Yep. The answer is no. The recording industry and Sound Exchange have been talking about setting up stuff like that publicly. But privately, there's been no movement in that direction.
Right.
Okay. So that's the answer to that one. And let me see. The other interesting little piece of news, and you may have read this already. Hillary Rosen, who is the CEO of the Recording Industry Association of America, is stepping down at the end of the year, saying that she wants to have more time with her twin four-year-old daughters.
Right.
And it's going to be interesting to see who replaces her, whether Carrie Sherman, who is the president of that, steps in, or whether they try and get, in fact, I was thinking the recording industry might try and get, let's say, a former politician who has been on their side to do it.
Well, you know, if I were them, I would try and find somebody a little bit less abrasive and confrontational and dogmatic.
I think I would agree.
Yeah.
But of course, if you think about it, the book publishers and the movie industry is, in fact, right now much more confrontational than the recording industry is.
It was fascinating to note that the movie industry is not playing ball over this new arrangement that IT companies and the music industry have reached.
That's true. That is absolutely true. They want it made completely illegal for people to be able to put movies onto their hard drives. There was, in fact, a couple weeks ago, there was a report on National Public Radio here in the States, and then it showed up, and then an elongated version of that report appeared on PBS's Public Broadcasting Systems, PBS's Now with Will Moyers, and it talked about the fear in terms of libraries, that the publishers, book publishers, are very scared that when libraries go completely online, that the only people that will buy the books are the libraries, and then everybody else will just download them free from the library. So now they want to see kind of an end to the kinds of access that U.S. citizens have had to the U.S. public libraries.
It really is a poser, isn't it? Because we don't want to create a situation where we have no incentives at all for artists to produce work.
Right.
And I've never had any difficulty. Since ACB Radio was being set up, we've always understood that at some point the royalty issue would be resolved. I think the difficulty I have is that they haven't come up with a model that's fair to both sides of the spectrum, really.
Well, their demands are so far apart. Their consumers want the easiest access possible. And they want, in terms of the music arena, they want to be able to put their music up on drives, and they want to have the same kinds of access, exactly the same kinds of access that they had before, except now it's on cyberspace. And on the other hand, the music industry, because of what you can do in cyberspace, specifically send one file out and have 1,000 people copy it, the music industry fearing that that people are going to stop buying music over this, wants great limitations placed on that, and they believe that the monetary value of music has gone down because of people doing file swapping.
I wonder whether what we're seeing is a new paradigm where the record companies just have to bow out. It seems to me that people will be far more willing to show their support for an artist by going directly to an artist website and paying, $4 or $5 for an album, let's say, knowing full well that the artist pockets every bit of that $5. It seems to me that there's a lot of animosity towards the music labels, who are the middlemen and raking in a lot of the dough.
That's true. One thing that has not occurred, and I would like to see it happen, so that the record labels absolutely fear this, is an artist creating something, music, putting it on his or her own website, and then allowing anybody to downloading it, and then having that song become a national hit.
Well,
that That's how you break down the middleman, and nobody's done it yet. But I have heard some people say, I mean, because you've got the software out there and everything now, that's only a matter of time.
Well, that will be interesting. The problem is, of course, is how do you define a national hit? Because at the moment, people tend to define that by looking at record sales.
Record sales and record sales and airplay.
And airplay, yeah.
And airplay. You could, I mean, again, you could look at how many sales were made through the artist's website, what the artist wants to report, or have the, if an artist were to do it this way, have SoundScan keep tabs on the website, okay? And then in terms of airplay, especially with all the blocking requirements here in the U.S., you would for web stations, you could very easily check out how much airplay the song was getting. So I don't think that that's going to be that big of an issue once something like that comes out.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it goes. And I noticed that there's an increasing number of services that are allowing you to download bunches of music, and they started off pretty stringent in terms of their limitations and are now relaxing a little. So whether that model takes off will be interesting to watch as well.
Let me jump subjects, because I know you have at least one other caller, and I want to let you get to them.
That's right.
I have two questions for you based upon what I heard on last week's show. Number one, concerning Windows 98 and the fact that Microsoft is not going to support that, does that also include Windows ME, Millennium Edition?
No, it doesn't. It's only 98.
Only 98. Good
yep.
Enough. Enough. Okay. And then my other question to you was, you also mentioned last week that Live 365 is dropping its WinApp access. Do you have a date on when that's going to occur?
Before the end of this month, I understand.
Okay.
I haven't heard that directly from Live 365. What I have heard from them directly is that you will have to log in as a listener before you're able to...
That is correct. You have to register now to use their. That's
right.
Correct.
So I think that there has also been a suggestion that therefore means that if they're going to require you to log in to listen, then they'll have to prevent players like Winamp from being able to directly access streams, because otherwise you wouldn't have to log in to listen.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. Now I'm still able to use. I'm actually using RealPlayer with it, but I'm using WinApp Access instead of RealPlayer Access,
right?
Which allows it to load directly into RealPlayer, and that hasn't stopped yet. But I was wondering if you had been given a date on when that's going to stop.
No, certainly I've been able to access Live 365 streams with WinApp still, because we no longer have anything to do with Live 365. I don't have any direct contact with them, so. Maybe somebody who is still broadcasting on there can give us further info on that.
Really? ACB? You know, your station is... The ACB station is still listed up with them. That's very interesting.
Yeah, and we are broadcasting on our own servers.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, with that, I will let you go, because I know you have at least one other caller.
Well, I appreciate your call, Ted, and do call again.
All righty, Jonathan. You take care and have a lovely week.
Thanks very much. Okay. Bye now. This is Blind Lime saying hello to area code 631.
Good evening, Jonathan.
Good evening, Nick.
All right.
Nice.
In the music business issue, I am violently pro-Kazaa. I am all for the whole free music thing. That's the way half of these bands become famous.
Well, there's a difference between a band choosing to make their material available through Kazaa and people ripping artists who do not choose to distribute their music that way and therefore violate copyright laws.
It doesn't matter. Even if they don't choose it, they still are becoming famous through that.
Oh, what? So you mean the Beatles are becoming famous, for example?
No,
because
not the Beatles. Not the old,
exactly.
Not the old bands.
Right. Well, it's not so much. That's what I'm talking about. I think that that it just... Well, it's stealing. There's no other term for it.
Well, I guess that's that. If you think it's stealing, it's stealing.
Well, how else would you describe it? How else would you describe...
We're not making money off of it.
But if you go and steal a candy bar from a store, you're not making money from it either, but you're still stealing. It's no, you are taking somebody's intellectual property without having paid money for it. And it doesn't matter whether it's intellectual property or physical property. If something is for sale and you choose to take it without paying for it, even though you know it's for sale, then you're stealing it.
I don't know how... I think we better change the subject here.
Fine. What's on next?
Yeah. I'm watching the Super Bowl.
Yes? Is it still 34-3 or whatever it was?
No. It's like 34-13.
Oh, they're catching up. How long has it got to go?
We're in the fourth. And it's a good thing the Bucks are leading, because I wouldn't want the Raiders to win.
Now, when you say we're in the fourth, does that mean like... You're in
the last quarter.
Okay. Oh, well, yeah. Not long to go now. So it looks like they're not going to. Looks like the Buccaneers are going to win.
That's from the looks of it. And I've got family in Tampa.
Oh, well, that's all right then.
Yeah. So really, if you're not going to root for the team, if you can't root for the team that's your team because they're not in the Super Bowl, then root for the team where you got some family.
Very good.
Yeah, man, if you can't root for that, then just root for whoever wins. Hey, and then just don't root for anyone.
Very good. Anything else?
You know what? This slipped my mind from last week. Do you have any idea what Freedom Scientific is going to do about Windows XP Media Center?
No, I don't. I don't know. I don't know whether they're going to do anything about it. Next time we have someone from there on the phone, on main menu, we will ask them.
All right.
Yeah, I'll make sure I make a note of that.
Well, I gotta go. Somebody just coughed up at the ball, and that's always a sign of something big that's going to come.
Well, I hope you have a lovely evening watching the Super Bowl.
All right.
Okay.
See you later.
Bye-bye. Ah, well. ACB Radio Mainstream, Blind Line. Hi there.
John Allen again. That guy Danny, if he happens to be around, or I sent you an email, you can definitely pass him my address.
Excellent.
You can email it to him.
We'll try and catch you guys up.
All right. Okay, John.
See ya.
Thanks.
Bye. You said maybe we should start a dating service. We could call it Blind Line Dates. Because is there a program in America called Blind Date? There certainly is in the States. In the UK, and there used to be one in New Zealand called Blind Date, so we couldn't use that. Oh, there we go. Nashville, this is area code 615. Hello there.
Hello there, Jonathan. How is everything going there?
Very well, thank you.
To my knowledge, we do not have any service here called Blind Date. The closest thing we've got, apparently... I know almost nothing about it. Something called Date Able out of Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Ah, okay. Well, you see, this Blind Date program that used to be on here and is on in the UK, I believe Cilla Black hosts it. Do you remember Cilla Black? Was she a big hit in America? She used to sing songs like Step Inside Love. Anyway, Cilla Black does Blind Date in the UK. It's not a blindness program. It's just... They get a couple of people together and send them off to, you know, Switzerland or something for a naughty weekend, and then they report back. So maybe we could use the term blind date if we wanted to do a dating show. That'd be a bit of fun.
I believe we actually do have shows like that here in this country. I've come across a TV show that seemed to do something like that. I have no idea what it's called.
So would you participate in such a program?
I would certainly try to participate in such a program.
Who would you? What's your ideal companion?
Well, let's see. I guess probably she would be at least age 35. She would be, I'd say, maybe 5'4" or shorter. I'm only 5'2".
Why do women always have to be shorter or about the same height as men? I mean, you know, you see lots of tall men and short women around. Why can't it be the opposite way around?
A lot of short women seem to want tall men.
Yeah, but why don't short men want to go out with tall women? I've been perplexed by this for years.
Well, I personally don't. I'd rather have someone close to my own height.
I see. Oh, well, anyway. Anyway, I'm probably going on a tangent. Did you ring up with a pearl of wisdom to share in any way?
Well, first of all, I will mention that I did come across several errors in the main menu archive page.
Good.
And if you will peruse that page heading by heading, you should be able to find several of those mistakes. One of them, you have the year incorrectly presented. You have 200 line 2. By line, I mean you have a carriage return. So the last digit of the year is on the second line.
Well, you see, it's interesting you bring this up because it took me quite some time to add the heading tag so that users of JAWS could navigate between shows just by pressing the H key. And no one's ever written in and said, hey, what a cool new feature. And here you are, ringing in, you know, poking the borax. You must admit it's a pretty good feature to be able to press the H key to switch.
Oh, it's a fantastic feature.
Oh, well, I'm pleased you like
it. I only got to use it for the first time a couple of days ago.
Yes. Lovely, isn't
Wonderful.
It? Yes, lovely. I will check that out at some point soon, then.
And I will mention that I believe it is the March 6, 2002 edition is not headed.
Okay, I will check that. I will check that.
And
that's because it's
items in there as well. Just it down heading by heading.
I think it was deliberate because March the 6th is Michelangelo's birthday.
Well, in that case, there wouldn't have been a program.
Oh, no, there just isn't a heading.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Now, on an entirely different subject.
Yes.
This war in Iraq that is anticipated.
Yep.
This administration, not all of them, but many of them, are, in my personal opinion, warmongers of the worst sort.
And I had you down as a redneck.
Never.
Well, there you go. It's just no telling.
Oh, you've got the Secretary of Defense, whom I call Remy. His assistant, whom I call Wolfie, that's Paul Wolfowitz. And you have the Vice President, Richard Cheney. All of them want war so bad they can taste it. And Remy, this past week, made a comment that to me sounded extremely desperate. So I started calling him Donald the Desperate. This is when he made the comment, you may have heard about this, where he referred to France and Germany as old Europe, and that the center of gravity is moving east. And he seems to think that having all these real tiny Soviet or former Soviet republics on as allies is really accomplishing something. Never mind their GDP combined is very small and their military effort even smaller. They really can't contribute anything to the effort.
Well, they're certainly having difficulty. I know that Colin Powell has been going around at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland over the weekend, having one-on-one meetings attempting to coax various nations into supporting action, and he doesn't seem to be having a lot of luck. There's a huge consensus saying give the inspectors more time. And I note today that Tony Blair has come out saying he agrees that the inspectors should be given more time. So even Tony Blair is saying that.
Yep. And most of us agree that Georgie Porgy has not in any way, shape, or form made the case for war. There is no imminent threat. There is actually no justification for war, period. I have no problem with the UN resolution, which everyone loves to tout, but which they forget the administration had to browbeat all the other countries on the Security Council to pass, and they had to tone down that resolution just to get it passed the way they did.
Well, he's got another shot at this, and that is the State of the Union address, and I think it could be one of the most critical speeches of his presidency coming up this week.
That is correct. And he will not make the case there either. In fact, apparently he's not going to say all that much about it, supposedly, because he wants to still have some, at least pretend, negotiations with Tony Blair 3 days later.
Well,
so I have a feeling that speech in the foreign policy arena is going to be a big disappointment.
It would be lovely to have a State of the Union address delivered by a president who actually mentions disability in a substantial form, or if at all. Have we ever had a State of, have you ever have, had a State of the Union address where disability has been mentioned?
Not that I can recall.
And yet there are 54 million Americans with disabilities out there, and you know, you often find that women and other minorities are mentioned, but not people with disabilities in those addresses.
I get the impression that a lot of the politicians really don't care about disabilities. I'm not disabled, so why should I care about it?
Well, very good thoughts. I will go and take this next call, and we will see what George has to say next week, your time. It's, of course...
Yeah, it will be in progress 48 hours from now, and I'm sure you will attempt to listen to it online.
Okay. Oh, yeah. It'll be on CNN, which we have on the satellite here, so I'll probably listen.
Yeah, that's right. You'll be able to watch it on CNNi.
Yes. I'm sure CNNi will cover it.
Yeah, be a nice, fun afternoon viewing for you.
Yes. And I hope you have a lovely evening, and please do continue to find errors on the website. We really enjoy that.
I just realized there's going to be a conflict. His speech will come on, well, actually... main menu will come on while his speech is in progress.
Oh, man. Maybe we should hold off main menu.
Well, I don't know. But
maybe we could rebroadcast the State of the Union and you could provide sort of expert analysis like that guy Schneider on the CNN.
Yeah, that's Bill Schneider there.
That's the one.
Their political analyst.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Mr. Pollster himself.
Oh, all right, then. Goodbye.
And check with you next time.
Okay, we'll look forward to it.
Right.
Bye-bye. Welcome to Spot the Error.
Hey, this here is Danny. I'm back.
Danny.
My connection was dropped.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Battery ran out.
Oh, man, I hate that.
So I won't be long because I didn't want to take up too much time, but I'll tell you, I just want to say one thing to the... people that don't think we should do anything at all, even pass resolutions about this war. I tell you, there are some people that think that Saddam Hussein is an angel, but I'll tell you what, I question not the Islamic religion as such, not the tenets of, you know, believing in Allah or whatnot, but I question the idea of anyone living under an oppressive government where people... Do you know that in a certain Arab country, there was a burning building, and some women who were running out were forced back into that building because they didn't have their head coverings?
No, I didn't.
I read that online.
And yet there are many other repressive regimes out there.
Right.
Are we, you know, is there going to be a coalition assembled to go after them all? And what sort of criteria does one use to determine...
Oh, I know. If you've got an oppressive regime that doesn't have nuclear weapons, and by the way, it's not nuclear. I hate it when people say nuclear.
Oh, we were talking about this on my other show on Interactive the other day. George W. says nuclear.
I know. I don't know why that got started. I mean, these are supposedly intelligent people. Why do they say nuclear? I don't understand.
Nuclear, yeah. It's annoying, isn't it? It really gets me.
It is annoying. Do you ever find people in the UK or other parts of the world saying that, or is that a peculiar American
thing? Well, certainly we have people here in New Zealand where I am who say nuclear, yes.
Huh. That is strange. Well, anyway... Granted, we cannot fix the whole world. And there might be some people that are happy living under a non-democracy. If you had some benevolent king or dictator or whatever, but he was treating his people fairly, maybe they're happy with it.